Welcome to Praxis, a podcast where we explore how to practice and embody the way of Jesus in our everyday lives. Thanks so much for taking the time to listen. So we're in a series right now focused on cultivating a healthy church culture. Every church has a culture, whether they realize it or not. Some church cultures are reasonably healthy, while others are not. And of course, no church is perfect. But part of the work every church needs to engage is to intentionally work to close whatever gap exists between being healthy and where they currently are. So in this series, that's what we're doing. We're seeking to close this gap. And this involves not only talking about the marks of an unhealthy church culture, but casting vision for how we as a church can embody a way of life together that, while it may not be perfect, is oriented toward goodness and kindness and love. So today we want to talk about a third toxin in the soil of an unhealthy church culture, and it's the misuse and abuse of power. Let's get into it.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Katie.
I'm Josiah.
And I'm Mac.
So we just got back from a two-day staff retreat up in Green Lake. Mm-hmm. We rented some cabins. We ate good food, a lot of food. One night I had three desserts. We went for walks, rested. I believe the two of you might have done a cold plunge. Did that end up happening?
We didn't.
No.
Okay.
And what I did apparently can't be considered a cold plunge because Adam and I went for a run and I was hot. So I just jumped in the lake and it was way too cold. I got out right away.
A cold dip.
Yeah, it was more like a dip.
It was like a dip.
More of a dip. We played games. That was one of my favorite parts. I laughed. I haven't laughed that hard in a long time. Like, I think I cried. So I was laughing so hard multiple times. But it made me think that maybe we should do a poll for our listeners. Is government a fascinating topic?
Oh, my goodness.
I claim that it is, and I guess I'm alone in that.
Well, maybe we should give some context. We were playing this game where you had to kind of guess what was the spectrum, like fascinating
or boring.
And the group sort of had to guess where it would be on the spectrum of government, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, based upon Katie's clue.
So I gave the clue government, which was supposed to lead them to guess slightly more fascinating than boring.
And everybody said boring.
Failed. They said, quote, it's the most boring ever.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it was just the assumption everybody in the room had. Well, of course it's on the boring side.
Yeah.
We just don't know how far on the boring side.
Yes. So it made me feel like a nerd.
Yes.
But it was fun. I'm coming back a little bit rested and also a little bit tired. I stayed up much past my bedtime, but I'm happy to be here.
Good.
How about you guys?
Yeah, I too felt like it was just a rich time as a team. I'm really grateful that we, you know, create that space to hive off and, you know, connect with one another. And also we had some really great conversations about what it means to stay centered and sort of focused on Jesus as a staff team and as individuals and continue to, you know, be moving in that direction on a daily basis. And I just love that conversation to hear where we're at and how we can continue to support each other in that journey.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a really beautiful time. I'm always drawn to the sappy parts of these retreats where we, you know, share encouragements with one another and have a lot of relational bonding. I feel like it makes working hard and being dedicated a lot more meaningful when you're doing it with people that you feel like are brothers and sisters.
Mm-hmm.
When we had Adam do a trust fall off the roof, that was awesome.
It was great.
We did not.
Just teasing.
I'm like, I need to update our insurance documents
for
some enhanced coverage.
That's funny. Well, we are in a series right now. We're focused on cultivating a healthy church culture. And because it's a part of a series, we would encourage you, if you haven't had the chance to listen to some of the previous episodes, please go back and do that. But big picture, we are talking about church culture. Every church has a culture, whether they realize it or not. And while some churches have a healthy church culture, many do not.
Healthy-ish,
yes. Many don't. And we're borrowing from Scott McKnight and Laura Berenger. We've been using this metaphor of a fruit tree to help us visualize what this looks like. So we're saying that a fruit tree has three main parts, that has the branches that bear the fruit, a trunk that supports and feeds the branches, and roots that suck up nutrients from the soil. And what we've been saying is that the most important part of this is the soil. Because if the soil isn't healthy, the tree won't be healthy and won't be able to produce healthy fruit. So over the last few episodes, we've discussed two toxins in the soil of the American church that are inhibiting kingdom fruit. We talked about celebrityism, which is that the church is driven by the personality of a leader, or growthism, which is just the church's success is being measured by numerical growth. So today we want to name and discuss a third toxin, and that is the misuse and abuse of power. Mm-hmm. So why don't we start, why don't we just get started by defining what we mean by power and maybe some of the assumptions we bring to the conversation on power.
I'm going to borrow, I think Diane Laneberg in her book Redeeming Power gives a good definition. She explains that the English word power comes from the Latin word posse. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. I don't know. But it means to be able. And so she says, quote unquote, power is having the capacity to do something, to act or produce an effect, to influence people or events, or to have authority. It can also have a harsher meaning, to master, dominate, coerce, or force. So I would say, maybe by way of providing a definition, guys, power is agency. Power is the ability to act. And in light of that definition, I think maybe we could name some of the assumptions that we bring to the table as we begin this conversation. One would just be that everyone has power. Everyone has some degree of influence. Even, just think about it, even the most vulnerable people have some degree of power or influence, some ability to act. Even a newborn baby has power. They can keep you up for the entire night, right? We've all been there. My son Griffin, who has Down syndrome, he may be seen as having less, you know, power as maybe a typical child, but actually he has tons of power and influence, tons of ability to act and shape things around him. So everyone has some degree of power. That would be one assumption. A second assumption I would say is that power is always at play, always. Because everyone has power, power is at play whenever two or more people are interacting, where you have like sort of everyone's agency is colliding and interacting and bouncing off of each other. This is true in marriage. It's true in parenting. It's true in organizations of all shapes and sizes. And it also is true in the church. And so there's this web of relationships where there's power or agency that's interacting and colliding. And especially when there's a hierarchy, for example, in a work environment, that just makes this interplay of power even more complex. Maybe one final assumption that I would say I bring to the table is that power is neutral. It's not inherently good or inherently bad. And this is captured in that definition. It's just the ability to act. And this one, though, I think is a little bit of a surprise because we've all heard sort of quotes about power that allude to how it can be misused. So, you know, there's that sentiment that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So sometimes there's this assumption that maybe all power is bad. And I think we would want to say, well, yes, power can corrupt and lead to misuse, but not necessarily. Doesn't have to do that. Power can be used positively or negatively. It's just simply the ability to do something. So the question is, how are you going to use it? My friend and coworker, Trisha Taylor at The Leader's Journey, says that it's like fire, you know, like fire is neutral. It's not good or bad. It's just neutral, but it can be used in good or bad ways. Mm-hmm. You can use it to cook food. You can also use it to burn down someone's house. You know what I mean? So that's kind of how power is. It's sort of like, it's like fire. It's neutral. And you can use it in different ways. And what we're wanting to say in this episode is that in unhealthy churches, power is misused and abused. And because of this, right? Because everyone has power. It's always at play. It's neutral. It can be misused and abused. It can be used positively or negatively. We just can't afford to ignore it. We can't afford to be blind to it. We need to learn to notice it and exercise it and interact with it in healthy and transformative ways. So what do you guys think? I mean, before we kind of go any further, are you guys tracking with that? Do you feel like it?
Yeah, I remember maybe a year or two ago, Mac, having a conversation with you where you made the comment that power is always at play in every interaction. And I think at the time, that was very new to me. Mm. Like there are some places where power is obvious, like within an organization or within hierarchy. But outside of that, I didn't really see it. But since that, I've had eyes to be able to pick that up more, more so. Like I see how power comes into play, even in seemingly... you know, kind of simpler interactions, even with like sibling dynamics or family dynamics or friendships. I mean, I really, I think that power is always at play, even albeit even in more subtle ways.
Yeah. I think maybe the word power can be misleading for some people because they don't consider themselves in positions of quote unquote power. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. But all of us are the psychology behind all of us are subconsciously trying to influence other people around us to get what we need. Like, and when you're unaware of that, even very normal, like where it seems like there's no power at play, relationships are sort of full of it, where you're sort of trying to influence the people around you in some sort of way. So I think I think helping define what power is, that it's just agency, it's the ability to influence. Mm-hmm. Helps us realize that this is at play absolutely everywhere and in every relationship we have.
Yeah, and I do think part of the growth curve in this particular conversation and with respect to this toxin is an ability to see it. Mm-hmm. And I'm hopeful maybe for our listeners that as this conversation continues, we'll be able to flesh out in more concrete ways how that shows up, mm-hmm. you know, give people some vision to be able to see, I guess, what we're trying to talk about. So why don't we just kind of go there? What are some common ways that you guys think power can be misused or abused in the church?
Yeah, the first one I would name is that power can be leveraged over people. Okay, well, let me back up and say this. In any church or organization, there's going to be some type of org chart, right? Like there's going to be some type of hierarchy where some have more power than others. Like it's unavoidable if you want to have an organization that works and where people can make decisions and have accountability, et cetera, et cetera. But in unhealthy organizations, I would say power is more used to force people to do things. I think there's a focus on like a specific outcome that the person in power wants, whether it's a project or an initiative or whatever. And then they leverage that power on people to get them to do the thing that they want. Mm-hmm. Right. So we've referenced quite a bit in this series, the book, A Church Called Tove, by Scott McKnight and Laura Berenger. And one of the quotes that I'm going to read from that book, so I thought it captures this idea well. They say, perhaps the most common temptation for church leaders is to wield their assumed authority and position as weapons of lethal, wounding power. When a leader manifests the power hatchet, a culture is formed that adjusts to the blade of fear. Mm. Power and fear are close companions. Mm. And then they go on to say that there's like, they give eight phases of what this looks like. And one of the phases is that the leader's approval becomes like the gold standard. So again, typically like the lead pastor, mm-hmm. whatever they want becomes the gold standard. Mm. And so I think this is insightful because it ties back into how we've talked in the past about tone at the top. Like the leader sets the tone. They say, okay, this is what I want. They maybe set a vision and then they assert that vision on everyone else. There's no opportunity for collaboration. It's sort of one person dictating orders. And then everyone around that person has a choice of how to respond. Those who fall in line and do what the leader wants, whether it means like late nights at the office and working crazy hours. Those who do that are going to receive some sort of like status elevation mm-hmm. for doing mm-hmm. it. And those who don't are probably going to experience guilt, fear, shame, and they're going to experience like a degradation in status. They're going to be pushed down and others are going to be brought up. So the leader's pastor becomes the gold standard. And then the leader asserts like fear, guilt, and shame to force everyone to to meet their standard and really to execute this outcome. I think it's very outcome-based. What would you guys add to that?
My goodness. Well, you've said a lot, and it's so good. I think, so just to summarize what I hear you saying, first thing you've said is that power is leveraged over people. Power is used to coerce and control. And the byproduct of that is it creates a culture of fear and shame.
Mm-hmm.
And people relate all the things we've talked about so far, like the personality-driven culture, mm-hmm. You know, church, like all of this is now weaved together. These mm-hmm. these dynamics are all playing off each other in unhealthy churches, where you have a lead pastor with all this authority and all this power, and then you're saying, okay, and the result is it creates a culture of fear and shame where people have to choose: do I just kind of, I guess, like, acclimate or sort of do what that person wants, in which case I get status enhancement mm-hmm. and maybe proxy power, or do I resist that, in which case I will be sort of my position or standing will be downgraded mm-hmm. and perhaps even I'll be shown the door.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
Yeah. I think the scary part of this to me is that it's so subversive in the sense that the lead pastor is not considering their own way to be selfish. Hmm. They and the organization equates what the lead pastor wants to do with what the Holy Spirit wants to do. Hmm. And how are you supposed to say no to your pastor mm-hmm. who says, we're doing this? When something in your own spirit says, I don't agree with that, mm. or I'm going to, like, my family's going to suffer because I can't draw good boundaries around how often I'm here and things like that. But how am I supposed to say no when what I'm being asked to do is, quote unquote, helping people or bringing people into the ministry or just name any of the other, you know, religious type of phrases you could add, in which I feel like I'm helping and I'm doing God's work. That's the scary thing to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this can happen really in any organization, but in a church, there's this added layer
yes.
of a tendency to equate what the lead pastor says essentially with God. Like yeah. they are the spiritual authority.
Yes. And I think that's why this is more important even for churches to figure out. Then, I mean, in any business, this would be healthy to manage mm-hmm. To manage the power dynamics at play. But in a church, it just puts another element, because we're not just responsible for helping people with their lives. We're shepherding souls
yes.
that are needing to see a clear picture of who God is.
Mm.
And Scott and Laura, I think, just do a brilliant job naming some of these patterns of how fear and shame are used, mm-hmm. you know, to produce outcomes and get people to conform. You know, you mentioned 8. I think it might be worth just briefly walking through those so that mm-hmm. people can see them.
Mm-hmm.
I have them in front of me here. One is power and authority are vested in an individual, which you've heard us talk about. Secondly, and this is what you were just saying, Josiah, the pastor's approval becomes the gold standard. And what they mean by that is that the pastor's power gets equated with God's approval,
mm-hmm.
right? So that, like, God's agenda and the pastor's agenda get fused together as if they're one and the same thing. And that becomes very sort of disorienting for people and puts them in no position to ask questions or, you know, challenge or anything like that. Thirdly, those approved by the pastor gain status enhancement. That's the proxy power that we were talking about. Those who do their bidding, who sort of get in line and conform to everything that the lead pastor wants to have happen, they get status enhancement and extra power. But power, fourthly, cuts with both sides of the blade. So along with power, here's what they say, along with the power of approval and the ability to confer status enhancement comes the other side of the knife, the power of disapproval and status degradation. So these people who derive their status from sort of conforming also fear losing it mm-hmm. all the time, mm-hmm. which is number 5. Judgments, number six, judgments and decisions are rendered behind a wall of secrecy, right? There's just a select few people who get to really call the shots and make the decisions while other people are sort of forced to adapt and respond to what those few people have decided is best.
And typically no transparency as to what goes into the decision.
Yes. Behind the walls of secrecy lurks a perpetual state of fear of status degradation. And finally, removal from the circle entirely. So banishment is the ultimate form of the power pastor's disapproval. And I'll just be honest, like I've experienced this before, you know, when I first stepped into ministry, I joined a staff team as a pastor. So I had a pastoral title, but it was totally like this, where whoever was kind of close to the lead pastor had this extra power and sort of protection. And I remember, even though I had a pastoral title, there were other people who were close to the lead pastor who would regularly give me directives and tell me what to do. And from an org chart perspective, it made zero sense. But I had no ability to like really interact with that because they were protected. I mean, at one point, I had a part-time person like regularly giving me directives, and I had no ability to sort of like—
Who wasn't a pastor.
Right, who was not a pastor. Like, and I had no ability to know like, what is going on here and how do I respond to this? Then about, you know, 4 or 5 years in, I end up getting a promotion. I become our executive pastor, basically. And all of that stopped immediately, which I just thought was kind of weird. Mm-hmm. I'm no longer getting directives. I'm no longer, like, people are no longer telling me what to do because I have a position of oversight over our staff. But I'm noticing other people are still getting those directives. Mm-hmm. And then at one point, there was some relational strain between me and the lead pastor, and I quickly got that demoted. And I went back to receiving sort of like directives. Even though I'm like the executive pastor, I'm receiving directives from an administrative assistant. Hmm. And it's just this web of like, this is messed up. Like, this is really jacked up. Hmm. And certainly we're really far from the kingdom of God where, as we'll come to see, these types of power dynamics are truly toxic. Instead of relating to each other as brothers and sisters in Christ without these, you know, status as this or that. I mean, think about that moment at the retreat. I know our listeners weren't there for it, but we have a part-time youth pastor who was just like, I'm just so grateful to be here because I don't think I belong. Mm-hmm. And all of us were just shocked. We were like, dude, you're essential.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That hierarchy, you're thinking things, it's not there. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, that I just think of it as authority can be used like currency.
Yes.
And it's handed out to people that are going to do the bidding of the person in charge, and it's mm-hmm. hoarded from people who are a threat to that. And the lead, unfortunately, often the lead pastor is the one with all of the making sure that their bank account of authority is always double or triple that of anybody else around mm-hmm. them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, anyway, so the first one is power over. It's your in unhealthy churches, power is used over people to demand conformity.
Another way we see this play out is that power is used to protect and promote the institution. Mm. I think we see this, it's, I guess for me, the easiest example is some of the mega churches who have experienced pastors who have when there's accusations of abuse, when they come to the surface, churches focus on image management rather than relational health. Mm-hmm. Like learning how some of these mega churches, when there's accusations come, they hire PR firms mm-hmm. essentially to protect themselves, mm-hmm. to protect the organization. And often the way that gets leveraged is not in a how do we do the right thing and make it look good for us. It's often used as we have the cards to play and we'll make sure no one finds out. And the shepherd is almost always prioritized over the sheep. Mm. And yeah, obviously it's very sad. And from a public standpoint, obviously the mega churches get the spotlight, but I don't think that it's just for mega churches.
Nope.
I think this happens in small churches too, where essentially that the protection of the church and the ministry gets put over the actual ministry itself.
Yeah.
Right? Instead of when a leader messes up, all the effort gets put on all of it gets spent on restoring the leader. And in turn, the abused or the people who are hurt often get dismissed and often blamed for the problem because God's trying to do something cool here and you're a threat to that.
Yes.
Because you're being honest about how the pastor hurt you.
Yeah. This is widespread. There's a guy named, his name is Wade Mullen, and he did his doctoral dissertation on how evangelical organizations respond to scandals, like, or when things bubble up, concerns or whatever. And so he looked at over, I think it was like over 50 evangelical organizations when they were faced with some sort of a crisis. And sadly, what he found is that they all basically do the same thing, which is what you're describing. They engage in impression management and hire spin doctors to sort of, you know, maintain the brand. And they strategically omit key information. They make ambiguous statements. They tell half truths. They evade questions. They do whatever it takes to try to control the narrative. Mm-hmm. And Scott and Laura in their book, I think, just do a good job naming that. Look, when there's a crisis that begins to bubble up in a congregation, how you respond will actually determine whether you're toxic or tove. If the response is really attending to the crisis, you know, and if you've done something wrong, then maybe confession and repentance is the first move, a commitment to finding out the truth. If the facts aren't known, all of that would probably be indicative of a tove or a good culture. We're going to take this seriously. If there's stuff that we don't know, like let's make sure we uncover all the facts of the situation. Let's attend to the impact this is having. Let's repent if we need to repent. Like all of that is a sign of a good and healthy church. But if on the other hand, you know, it's the knee-jerk response is denial, you know, rejecting it, you know, scapegoating, these types of things. That immediately is an indication of a toxic culture.
Yeah, and think about what makes this so toxic is not just that you made a mistake in judgment. The problem is that the entire reason your church exists is to be a community for the sheep. Mm. And the shepherd is to lay down their life for the sheep, for the sheep's good.
Yes.
And if when push comes to shove and something and a sheep is hurt by the shepherd and instantly everybody around the entire culture goes to protect the shepherd and to dismiss sheep and cast them out and hopefully they'll find another herd somewhere else, like that it's completely backwards.
What a crazy inversion.
It's completely backwards to the entire culture, the entire way the culture is supposed to be.
Yeah.
And I think that it's important to name because as what you're naming, the way you respond to things when the lead pastor or a leader makes a mistake, the way you respond to that is an indication of where the culture already is. Mm-hmm. By then, it's kind of too late.
Right.
I mean, in a sense, like if the entire herd of sheep, if we're just using the analogy, is there focused on making sure the pastor is okay, when then that already indicates the whole thing is kind of messed up.
And I think in the moment, like when something happens, let's say a lead, you know, lead pastor did make a mistake, it can be scary to look at the truth of what happened and to be honest about it and try to figure out how to address it. It can be really scary. And I think it makes sense just looking at normal human behavior, you know, and kind of this, like the self-preservation. It makes sense that our first inclination, especially if you're at the top of the org chart, is to sort of protect, like nothing to see here. Let's hire a PR firm to like craft a message, to paint a picture that really doesn't look like reality. Like if you want to tell the truth, then just tell the truth. Why do you need a third party to help you craft a message to tell a story? But again, what you're saying is, what's the end game? Even though it's scary in the moment to reckon with what's actually happening, doing so will prevent a lot more hurt and harm and just degradation to the culture in general.
And because if there has been an actual abuse by a leader and then everybody around them sort of rushes to protect them rather than attend to the person hurting, and it works. Well, now that leader is just more emboldened to continue those mm-hmm. patterns because they have protection for doing those very things. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing this. We're seeing this on a denominational level with the SBC and some of these bigger churches that, like, when they responded with protecting the pastor and the organization and the brand, well, it actually led to, like, multiple cases of abuse, not just one. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right? Okay, so power over... power is used, secondly, to protect and promote the institution. Let's talk about a third one that is used to distort reality and hide the truth. So in a toxic church culture, power is used, and we were hinting at this with the image management stuff. It's used to distort reality, reality distortion, and hide the truth of what actually happened. So rather than focusing on relational health, Josiah, what you were just talking about, you know, fact-finding, truth-telling, the focus becomes seeking to control the narrative to protect the reputation of the pastor and the church. And in Church Called Tove, they name eight ways this happens. And I just think it'd be good to walk through these. One, the first move is you discredit the critics. So instead of admitting the truth, this is what they say, instead of admitting the truth of an accusation, they discredit the accuser instead. They flip the script. Secondly, they demonize the critics. So if that first step doesn't work, well, then the second one is a full-on character assassination of the person who's bringing the concern or the accusation, and it creates an us versus them. Usually it's rooted in some sort of, hey, we're with God.
Yeah.
This is us.
They're the enemy.
Mm-hmm. Me and God, and you are them, aligned with Satan. You know what I mean? So it's like this us versus them dynamic where we're on God's team and you're clearly not. Thirdly, they spin the story. This is the public deception piece. They say spinning the story is a deceitful strategy designed to hijack the accuser's narrative and create an alternative version, mm-hmm. an intentionally false narrative that supports the pastor and the church while creating doubt about the allegations. Mm-hmm. Fourthly, they gaslight the critics. This is where they sort of challenge the critics' understanding and recall of what actually happened to the point where they might even doubt their understanding of reality, what actually transpired. Five, they make the perpetrator the victim. This is what we've talked about this before. Darvo, deny, mm-hmm. attack, reverse order, victim. All of a sudden, the pastor who is the abuser becomes the victim, and the person who's the victim is actually the oppressor. They've inverted it, as you said, that the sheep becomes the oppressor rather than the shepherd who caused the harm. Six, they silence the truth. Often this comes in the form of non-disclosure agreements, signed documents, things like that. If they refuse to sign, seven, they suppress the truth. This often involves silencing the truth. Some sort of, intimidation tactics are often used here. And then eight, they issue a fake apology. And Scott and Laura say a cheap apology is no apology at all. It's just a continuation of the false narrative. So I don't know if that's helpful. It was to me to go, okay, here are some of the signs that reality is being distorted and truth is being hidden.
Yeah. Yeah. To me, it's just interesting to see. I think that the perpetrator of someone abusing power, it's easy to say they're doing it so intentionally on purpose, like this is a process they're calculating in their mind. They're going to, Darvo yep. and all this stuff. I think as you were reading those, what's coming to my mind is like how natural that progression is.
Mm. Yeah.
Like, yeah. Once you start down the process, you either have to come clean or it's just going to turn into the next thing. And it'll be all eight of those steps.
And your narrative becomes your reality, right? Like people who do this a lot and don't intentionally, veer back to the truth, like make a commitment to the truth. I think once you spin a narrative and everyone else buys into it, like that distorted narrative becomes reality.
Yep. Scary.
It is scary.
It's like the essence of self-deception.
Yeah.
And of course, and I've said this before, but like the essence of the reason why deception is so scary is because it feels the exact same way as being right. Hmm. Those two feel the same way. When you're right, you feel right. When you're self-deceived, it feels like you're right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's super scary to me.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Yeah. I don't think that people are pretending that their narrative is right. I think that it is a full on all of life and soul belief that you are right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that, go ahead, Mac.
Well, just to maybe double click on what you said, Katie, that's why that moment, that first response is so important, because it sets you on a trajectory of either formation and transformation, or one of
small compromises.
Yeah.
That's what I was going to say. It's the small compromises that just kind of snowball.
Yeah. And I also kind of like that we can humanize this a little bit. It is human nature to protect yourself or the thing you care about. Mm-hmm. So that is not to say that we're not going to like feel bad that you would want to protect the institution. Of course, like that would be your human nature. But hopefully, as we learn some of these things and tools and you know, for our own church, that we would be able to recognize that instinct when it happens. If one of us has, makes a mistake and inadvertently hurts someone, we've even talked about it within our own staff culture. Mm-hmm. Sort of starts there. Mm-hmm. We have a choice, and you feel that in the second, it happens, defensiveness. Mm-hmm. Wait a minute. I think you're wrong and blah, 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 blah. And if you just let that settle for a second, you realize, I think there's a more faithful response, and it's going to involve humility over self-protection.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So power can be used to distort reality and hide the truth. It can be used to protect and promote the institution. It can be leveraged over people. And a fourth one I would name is that power can turn conflict into a zero-sum game. So in unhealthy organizations, we've been talking about how power is kind of a hot commodity. Like if an organization is built on the idea that power translates to the ability to get your way, then those who have power call the shots and they exert their will on everyone else. And those without it are treated like sheep who just have to like go along. And when power becomes the only way to be treated with respect in an organization, then I think power becomes like a scarce resource. Like there's not enough of it to go around. Mm-hmm. And that's because that the more that power is shared, like the more diffuse it becomes. The more I want to exert power as a form of control, the more I need to make sure that I'm the only one with it and that no one else can have it. So in unhealthy organizations, I would say that someone else having power threatens my power, right? It's like a zero-sum game. There's only 5 apples on the table, and if you get 3, there's only 2 left for me, which in turn creates winners and losers. Those who have it win, and those who don't have much of a voice. Like they tend to get, let's say, blamed for things unfairly. I think they can function as like scapegoats because they don't have the ability to speak up or to challenge decisions or to challenge the narrative. And so this unhealthy version of power really turns it into like a zero-sum game.
Yeah. Maybe just a compare and contrast. In healthy churches, conflict it's never fun, and it certainly can get messy. I'm not saying it doesn't, but it's hopefully entered into in relatively healthy ways, right? There's mutual sharing and listening, and people lean in with empathy and take ownership for themselves and how they contributed to the conflict, right? And those with power actually go first. They ask questions. Mm. They seek to understand, right? They acknowledge their impact on those around them. So they seek to listen and understand. They lean in with empathy. They create safety and thank other people for sharing. They own anything that they could have done differently, right? This is what happens in a healthy church culture. Conflict is actually transformative. But see, in an unhealthy church culture, conflict is exactly as you're saying. It becomes a zero-sum game of winners and losers. And those with power, because they're threatened, they just use their power to continue to hoard power. Rather than listening, they talk. They impose their reality onto others rather than trying to understand others. They use their power to compromise safety and create fear instead of sharing honestly. They don't own anything because they don't really have to. When you have all the power and no one else can do anything about it, I don't really have to own anything, right? Mm-hmm. There's often not consequences, at least not imposed on people with power. I think there's plenty of intrinsic sort of natural consequences in this type of culture. But the point is that exactly as you're saying, there's going to be conflict in organizations. When power is used in unhealthy ways, it actually blocks our transformation and becomes this game of winners and losers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you can see this evidenced really well in what you do if you're in a position of power and someone disagrees with something you did. Hmm. When they come to you with, I didn't like that, or there's a criticism, right? Of course, it's normal. It's natural to be defensive.
Yeah.
If you tried and poured your heart into something and someone didn't like it, of course. But the inability to have those types of conversations with people that disagree with you, and I think it's an evidence of this, where if I'm in a position of authority and someone comes to me and says, I think you maybe made a mistake, or I didn't care for this decision, or maybe this is a deficiency, maybe something you're missing. If my first instinct is to get defensive, to sort of dismiss them or discredit them, I think this is what's happening. You're sensing, like, in order for me to be humble here and to listen and to care, I have to surrender a surrendered amount of power, mm-hmm. an amount of power, in order to sit and listen to you. And I think that, you just see that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
I even see it with my kids. Like, I don't like admitting if my kids are right about mm-hmm. something that maybe I did wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, like I challenge my oldest daughter on her phone and try to help her manage how much she's on it. But if she catches me on mine and I'm just scrolling on something, everything in me wants to be, you're on it way more than me.
Yeah.
This isn't a problem for me. It is for you, blah, 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 blah. But right, because it feels like a loss of power. Like I had this over her mm-hmm. where I could influence her because I was the one with the perfect example. Mm-hmm. And if I lose that, it can feel like I'm losing power. But often those are moments that are transformative for a leader to admit, maybe you're right. You were right. I didn't, like, I shouldn't be on it.
Totally.
All right, so we've named a lot of stuff about power. We've talked a lot about how messed up it can get. So the big picture is power is used in unhealthy church cultures to control and coerce other people. And so if we're, as we've been doing with this whole thing, we don't just want to name the problems. We also want to name what it looks like for us to press into and to relate to power in a healthy way and in a Christ-like way. So what does that look like?
Yeah. I mean, the last thing we want to do is just point out a bunch of problems and be like, oh, see you later. You know? So look, if we're going to turn the corner and begin to like reconstruct or cast vision for something healthy, it starts with Jesus. We need to learn how to relate to power in the way of Jesus. And look, Jesus was not power blind. Jesus saw how power was at work around him. He's acutely aware of it. Look, on the one hand, this wasn't hard for Jesus because he lived on the underside of power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jesus lived at a time when the Roman Empire exerted all sorts of oppressive influence, you know, and exploited people. And Jesus was from a no-name town in the middle of nowhere and would have felt that oppression. So on one hand, I mean, this was a time when like 95% of the population was living hand to mouth with 5% who had all the power and resources. So Jesus was part of that minority culture that was being exploited and used to oppress and control. On the other hand, Jesus also had some power and he was aware of that. For instance, he was a male in a patriarchal culture that carried a certain sense of power. He had power. He was considered a rabbi, which is sort of a position of notoriety and prestige. So there's a sense in which Jesus knew he was aware of the power around him.
He was also God.
So, yes.
There's that too.
God in the flesh. Yeah. And of course, you know, that's the mind-blowing part of the gospel, right, Adam? That like God incarnate would take on flesh and is in a manger, right? Mm-hmm. That here is God and he goes to the cross for us, right? Mm-hmm. This is how God embodies his power.
He chooses to inhabit a mostly powerless position rather than coming as a king.
Yes. Yes. And Jesus taught explicitly about power. There's a story where the disciples were sort of vying for the best position and who's going to be first. And Jesus says, look, that's not how it's supposed to be among you. That's the way the Gentiles use power. They lord it over other people. And then to your point, Adam, he goes, not so among you, for even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but rather to serve and to give his life away as a ransom for many. Like, this is what God does with God's power. He lays down his life. And so Jesus is describing, he's critiquing that the very thing we just got done describing in this conversation. He's critiquing power over, using power over to coerce and control, to exploit and to oppress, to demand compliance and conformity, to secure and procure outcomes. And Jesus explicitly says that is not the way it's supposed to be among you. So look, and in taking on flesh, I would also say, like, Jesus also redefines power as self-sacrificial love, as redemptive love. So again, Adam, I thank you for chiming in, because you're like, he was also God. Yes. And in taking on flesh, he redefines power almost completely. He redefines power as a love that delivers, a liberating love. The power that Jesus expressed is a self-sacrificial love that delivers and rescues and redeems. It's a Calvary-like love, a cross-shaped love. My friends Matt Tebbe and Ben Sternke from Gravity Leadership, they wrote a book called Having the Mind of Christ. And in it, they have sort of these axioms that kind of, I guess, highlight the paradigms that Jesus, the frames that Jesus used to approach life. One of them was that Jesus reckoned with power. And they just do a great job, I think, in their chapter talking about this, how Jesus saw the power dynamics around at work around him. He even redistributed power within the broken systems and structures that were at play. So you'll see him kind of, Katie, you named, like, kind of taking on the person who is powerless, who is marginalized. He intentionally moves towards them mm-hmm. and sort of like elevates their standing, and mm-hmm. often does so at the shame of those who are exploiting or mm-hmm. oppressing. And of course, in the long run, he's completely inverting or flipping the entire thing upside down and points to a telos or a goal where power is inhabited in a completely different way. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
So I know I said a lot, but I kind of got on a roll and...
Yeah.
Couldn't stop.
It was a great role. It was a great role.
That's good.
I too, you know, read the book by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe and revisited the chapter on power for this conversation, because I thought they had so much good stuff to say. And one of the things they touched on is exactly how Jesus did what you're naming, Mac, like how he moved towards those that didn't have power and elevated them. And a few specific examples is one with women.
Yes.
I guess being the only woman in this room, it's been really helpful for me to see the ways that in a culture that really like kept women down, they had almost no power. He taught them. He allowed them to be his disciples. He treated them with dignity. He honored them. Like, he empowered them in all these ways that were highly countercultural at the time.
Another, at cost to himself.
At great cost to himself.
Yeah, yeah. Like, mm-hmm. like Luke 7, there's a woman who comes in and is like, got a sinful woman, quote unquote, like a prostitute, and is anointing Jesus' feet and crying. And Simon, this Pharisee, is like looking down on her in judgment. What does Jesus do in that moment? He like defends the woman and shames the Pharisee. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that would have been shocking.
It was totally shocking. Mm-hmm. Something similar happens in John 8 with a woman who's caught in adultery. Mm-hmm. He responds by essentially forgiving the woman publicly and shaming those who had stones in their hands. Mm-hmm. Right? These are all situations where power dynamics are at play, and Jesus is exposing that power for what it is and redefining it as cruciform love, liberating love. And it flips the power structures upside down, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. And another one, it would be like physical healing. Mm-hmm. You know, if you had some sort of physical disability or leprosy or, you know, some sickness, like, you are out.
Excommunicated.
Yeah, there wasn't welfare programs.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Well, yeah. And so by healing, he was not only just providing physical healing, he was restoring them to their place in society and to their place yes. in the community. So I do think he was always doing this. And when we look through the Gospels and we read these stories through the lens of power, we see something really neat. Mm-hmm. So one thing I would name is that we can do, if we're saying like, okay, what do we do with this? How do we've kind of deconstructed, how do we reconstruct a healthy idea of power? The first thing I would say is we need to learn to notice and name power dynamics, right? We can't address what we can't name. So if we want to reckon with power, then we need to learn to see it and name it. So taking an example, I've used this as a reference point in the past in this podcast, but one of my former positions, I worked in compliance in higher ed, and one of the areas I dealt with was Title IX compliance. And Title IX prohibits discrimination and harassment on the basis of sex. So we would have sexual harassment investigations, and every once in a while, there would be a case between like a professor and a student of sexual abuse or harassment. And those cases carried really, like really significant power dynamics. Mm-hmm. So you might have a professor, typically a male, typically a female student, not always, but usually. And there would be some allegation that the student brought forward, or sexual harassment or abuse. And the professor would typically respond with something along the lines of, well, she's an adult. Like, we're both consenting adults. She could have said no. And the question is like, well, could she? Could she have said no? Right? If you are a person who has the power, not only for of like a grade, but like literally the power of whether or not this person can go on to have a successful career and get a job and pursue the thing that they've devoted years and lots of money to, like, did she really have the freedom to say no? And maybe she says she did, but then it's his word versus hers. But my point is, if you're going to look at that situation, it's impossible to really see what's happening with the truth mindset if you don't acknowledge and name the power dynamics at play.
The power differential.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'll just say I've probably been in my own, like when it comes to the church, I've been in my own journey in being able to do this. You know, I think when I first stepped into ministry, like I was for the most part completely blind to what we're talking about. I either didn't see it or chose not to see it. That was kind of my first phase. The second phase is I pretty much got crushed by it. Like I learned the hard way by being, you know, on the underside of that, the mystery. I got hurt. And then when I became a lead pastor for the first time, I'll be honest, my knee-jerk reaction was to go to the far opposite, sort of let the pendulum swing and try to avoid any power that I had because I was so afraid to misuse it. And I would say in this most recent season, over the last few years, I've been working really hard at being able to name the power that I have, not abrogate it, you know, pretend it's not there, but to name it, own it, and share it with those around me. And I'm not doing it perfectly, but I'm in process, and I think I'm figuring out how to do that more effectively each day. You know, so let's just take us as an example. You guys, I'm your friends. You know, mm-hmm. I've hung out with both of you outside of work. I know a lot about your lives, not pertaining just to the responsibilities you have. Like, you know, you guys are close friends of mine. And yet I'm also like in a supervisory role. Mm-hmm. So there's this dual dynamic. There's a power dynamic at play. And I haven't always known how to navigate that well. And I would say one of the things that I'm trying to do is just to name that with you and allow you to name it when it's at play so we can be aware of it. These dual dynamics, boss and friend. Mm-hmm. How do we name that so that there's openness and honesty, transparency, and there's not the misuse or abuse or confusion around those things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it reminds me at the retreat, some of the spiritual practices and disciplines we were discussing about doing as a staff had a lot to do with our own spiritual life. Mm-hmm. And we talked about what healthy accountability looks like on staff to say, we want to be able to support you depending on which season or how you're experiencing things. And we sort of had to name that sometimes accountability partners that are on a church staff, if it's a supervisory role, can feel a little wonky because you're not quite sure the blurred lines between what's work and what's personal. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean we shouldn't, but naming it is sort of like, okay, now there's now we're able to name what you're comfortable with, what you're not. And if you don't, it could have easily been like, no, this is something you have to do because you're on church staff and we care about this. Mm-hmm. But being able to name it and talk about how you experience accountability in your own personal journey on a church staff, because a lot of that just becomes fused. But being able to name it, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Being able to name it sort of lowers anxiety around it.
Yeah.
Naming it is always the first step, right? We can't talk about what we can't name.
Yeah, I would say right along with that is to place a high priority needs to be placed on relational health.
Which is kind of what you were just describing, right?
Yeah.
Like, how do we relate to this idea of accountability in healthy ways, where accountability isn't just demanding conformity of those around me, but it's actually like allowing them to say their yes and their no, and then cheering them on to be true to that.
Mm-hmm.
And if they aren't able to do that perfectly, instead of coming with a hammer of fear, guilt, and shame, you didn't do it well, getting curious about it. Getting curious about, hey, what happened? How can we unpack what happened? How can I support you? What are you learning mm-hmm. through this? Like, that just feels very different to me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Getting what you want out of someone needs to take a backseat to a healthy relationship. And that's difficult because most churches are structured like businesses. I mean, they are a business, right, in reality, but I think it takes a lot of work to say we care more about you as a person than we do about your output and what you can do for the organization. Mm-hmm. And that's also risky because mm-hmm. then employees are going to take advantage of grace and things like that. Of course it's going to happen. But being able to understand the importance of relational health, the relationships you have, and prioritizing those allows you to be a shepherd to sheep rather than a taskmaster to a slave. And I think when that priority is in the right order, I think it has ripple effects throughout the whole community. You know, taking stock in each of your own individual relationships as a leader and being able to acknowledge the power at play. Like, how does the power dynamic affect my relationship with so-and-so? That would be a good place to start if you're in a position of power. I mean, I've already named, I think a place like that is ripe for it is at home with our kids. Mm-hmm. If you're a parent, mm-hmm. how do these dynamics affect our relationships? Power affects my relationships with my kids a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And how I show up in the spaces with my kids is like, I don't know. It's really important to name. But I think one of the things you named sort of really quickly, Mac, that is probably worth expounding on in this point is that the leader always has to go first with reckoning these power dynamics. Because the person who doesn't have the power can't demand this power dynamic shift. They can, but it often won't go well.
Well, unless they invite it. So maybe just like let's reflect on our staff culture for a moment. I feel like I've tried to, I would say, if someone has a concern or a problem or they have a wonky interaction with me, and if I'm not aware of it, to come talk to me. So there is that permission I've given people repeatedly to know that, like, hey, you don't have to be scared of that. My commitment is to listen and to understand and try not to get defensive. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, so there's an open invitation that, hey, yeah, an unhealthy power, there's no way for you to voice that. When power is used in a healthy way, everybody has an invitation to move towards each other. And we actually have tools, assuming that there are going to be those messes along the way. Mm-hmm. You know, go back and listen to the podcast we did on how to clean up a mess, you know, because mm-hmm. that's really just an outworking of what do we do when things get messy, knowing we want healthy relationships with one another and there are power dynamics at play.
Yeah.
So for instance, maybe I'll share an example to give our listeners an idea. So heading into Lent, We did this, I think, pretty well. We were heading into Lent, and we were thinking about doing an Ash Wednesday service for the first time, and yet it fell on a Valentine's Day. We thought, okay, like, we'll save it for next year. And instead, we wanted to put together, like, make our chapel available for 24 hours and have, like, a Lenten devotional. And Katie, you kind of did some work on mapping some of that out. Somewhere along the line, the ball got dropped a little bit. And it wasn't announced the way it probably should have been to our congregation to fully take advantage of what we had planned. And then as a team, we were in our weekend planning team meeting, and we just kind of like brought that up. And I probably had some narratives about who I thought dropped the ball the most or whatever. And I tried not to like lead with that and start with like, I could have done a better job communicating, you know, which is true. I could have done a much better job communicating and making sure everybody knew exactly what they were supposed to do. And I felt like in that moment, everybody sort of leaned in and said, yeah, we probably could have done a better job as a team. How did we get here? It kind of shifted from blaming people mm-hmm. to going, what happened as a team? How can we like identify the areas we each could have done differently and learn from this?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't think we were able to have that conversation unless you first really focus on relational health. Like it takes trust. I think I was the one that raised that conversation, and that's because I trust you all well enough to go like, hey, I think we as a team missed something. Like, let's talk about that.
And I think a lot of the work ended up falling on your lap kind of last minute, and there was a little bit of a, you know, who was supposed to do what type of thing.
Yeah, I think this is so important. And if I can just say one more thing on this point, just how you said, hey, people, if we focus on relational health, people might take advantage of that. And I think that that's true. They might. But I also don't think that having a culture that prioritizes relational health is mutually exclusive with having like an unhealthy relationship to power, right? So it doesn't mean that if we prioritize relational health, we can't have accountability. I think we can. Yeah. We absolutely can. It just looks different. And in some ways, I think is more effective because the trust is there to go like, hey, this didn't happen. Why didn't it happen?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so just to review, we've said you've got to notice and name when power dynamics are at play. A high priority needs to be placed on relational health. I would share another one, which is just that power should be shared across a team of mature people. I won't spend a lot of time here because we've touched on this so many times in this podcast. Mm-hmm. But of course, we're kind of pushing back against this pastor, lead pastor as CEO who has all the power and authority. That is just a recipe for disaster. And it's obviously not taught in the New Testament. In the New Testament, you see power being diffused across a team of mature Jesus followers who know how to shepherd a community rather than exploit the sheep. And so it is with us, you know, again, we don't do this perfectly, but we're trying to embody that model in our leadership as a church to go, look, we're going to share power across a team of people. And within that is actually built in accountability. Mm-hmm. Sharing power actually limits the abuse of power because there's like these natural checks and balances mm-hmm. In place, you
mm-hmm.
know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we talked about government at the beginning of the episode. My mind kind of goes to government.
Yeah, because like there's like a checks and balances built into, you know?
Yes, the in our system of government, there's a system of checks and balances, and that's very different from having a king with no one that they report to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When you have systems set up so that there's not just one person who has the final word no matter what, you're going to by nature share power.
Yeah, I think maybe just one thing I would add to this is maybe you're listening and you're not the lead pastor who determines the org chart, but maybe you're in a position of power because you're a parent. I think sharing power across a team of mature people, this could look like just being willing to surrender certain elements of your power in order to empower your own children. I mean, think about the way you handle even conversations on a more granular level. Am I quick to bark orders or do I allow myself to stop and take time to ask questions and to get their feedback mm-hmm. on something?
Mm-hmm.
Allow them to take ownership of things and be able to trust them instead of being dogmatic and preachy about mm-hmm. about the things I want them to do. What does it look like to ask questions first and to humble myself enough to lay down some of that power.
Absolutely. And it doesn't need to be in the big things like, hey, mom, I want to wear my pajamas to school. Okay, well, no. But even like with young kids, you can give them choices and, well, do you want to wear this outfit or that? I mean, I think in really small ways, you're absolutely right. There are ways to embed this and to get our kids comfortable with having some agency. If power is agency, how do we give them the opportunity to step into agency and use that in healthy ways, even at a young age?
And long term, that's kind of the goal of parenting is to not just like for the rest of your life exert power over your children.
Well, mm-hmm. you know? I think some people would prefer that.
Maybe. But, you know, like it seems to me that like adults who have adult children who have healthy relationships with their parents, that isn't the primary way they operate. Somewhere along the line, they began to function as equals.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Where they learned how to relate to each other as adults rather than primarily out of this power differential.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They learned to honor each other's agency and ability to act rather than one person sort of dictating that over the other person. And again, to piggyback on what both of you are saying, there's hundreds of opportunities to do that in a given week where you're letting your kids have agency, giving them the ability to act in ways that are self-directive, but also limited, right? Mm-hmm. You're limiting some of the choices for their own good, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. So we're talking about what would it look like for the church to use power in healthy ways. We've said, first, learn to notice and name power dynamics. Second, place a priority on relational health. Third, Mac, you named share power across a team of mature people. And then fourth, I would say we need to commit to repentance and truth-telling. Mm. So we can have this conversation about power and we can try our best to use it in healthy ways, but that won't always happen, right? We'll all make mistakes. We all have power and we'll all leverage it in unhealthy ways. And when we do, we commit to repent. As Christ followers, we're called to be truth-tellers. John 8:32 says, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." So what this means is I think when we make mistakes, we recognize it, we name it, we repent from it, and we name the truth of what happened, the full truth.
Yeah, it's really hard because you've got to trade out sort of story spinning for transparency and honesty. Mm-hmm. You know, one way I've noticed that showing up for us is when there's like some sort of a departure, like a staff departs from our team. That's something that we've spent a lot of time working through, which is just like, I'm not willing to say something that's untrue in order to like kind of sugarcoat it, you know? So I'll give an example of, I think when we did this well, one of my best friends on the planet, Jody Bean, you know,
I hope he's listening.
Yeah, that'd be great. I just love Jody and it was such a gift to be able to serve as partners in ministry together. And yet he was really far from any family. And they created their family here. Like they had their kids here and yet felt really distant from any immediate family and eventually made the decision to move closer, to have a greater support system. That was a really hard decision that they had to make as a team and a family unit. And but when he told me that and said, "Hey, here's what we're discerning as a family and our next step," we had a lot of conversations just to go, man, is there anything else going on other than that? And if so, there's obviously like discretion. How much does everybody need to know? There's always like that discernment of like who needs to know what and when. But I just told Jody, I'm like, I'm not willing to say anything that's untrue. So or pretend. I'm not going to do that. Eventually the truth comes out and I want to be able to stand before our congregation in good faith, vouching for here's why you're leaving. Here's why your time on our staff is coming to an end so that I can invite others to champion. If this is truly a God step, we want to champion that with you, you know? And I've seen both here and in other places times when that just was not the case. Years of like relational harm and mistreatment done to staff members. And then when they finally have had enough and they choose to go, it's not like, hey, I was mistreated for a long time and I can't take it anymore. It's like those who have the power are the ones who make the announcement and they sort of spin it in some sort of congratulatory way. Like they're moving on to this bigger, better thing. Like, and it's just like bogus. Mm-hmm. And eventually people find out, you know, because they do. And that erodes the trust of our congregation because we don't feel like we're trafficking in the truth. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. It takes a lot of, you have to let go of the control of the outcome a little bit and choose to be faithful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And truthful and trust that character is going to win out in the end, or I should say integrity. And I don't just mean integrity to what I want or in some sort of arbitrary way. I just mean like in following Jesus and choosing to be truthful and honest, knowing that in the end that's going to determine how it ends up. But it's a way easier. I should say easier. I shouldn't say easier. It's not necessarily less work. I guess you get a lot more from being able to control it yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of temptation for that.
You might say it's more tov. Mm-hmm.
Oh. That's so good. I don't know. This is what I'm thinking. It's just like part of the task of leading in a church is to repent publicly. And it stinks. You know, because I'm not going to lead perfectly. I'm going to make mistakes along the way. It's just part of it. I'm not Jesus, newsflash. You know? Yeah. But I also think there's a win in that. If you can learn how to own your mistakes publicly, and you're actually modeling what it means to be a community of Jesus followers, because that is the way. It's like the way of repentance is to continue to own the gap between where I am and where I'm supposed to be so that I can continue to grow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you sort of give permission for everybody to then be part of that work, you know?
Yeah, I think that it's worth naming that there's definitely a line of thought within certain church leadership that I have observed in which a pastor or a leader is going to assume that I can't show any weakness. Mm-hmm. I can't show cracks in my own spiritual journey. Mm-hmm. Because that will like cause people to not trust me. Then they're not going to look up to me as a leader. And that's going to shift this whole thing that's all built on them looking up to me. Mm. So I know that goes a little bit to the image management thing, but I do think that it's worth deconstructing for people who have been raised in that to say that I couldn't apologize or admit I'm having a hard time being honest and vulnerable if I'm struggling right now. All those things would be off limits for a leader.
Yeah, that feels like a really big weight to carry.
Yeah,
if I'm honest.
So this has been a fun and long conversation. Let's start to wrap it up by talking about some like concrete practices.
If it weren't for this coffee, I'd be exhausted right now. You know.
Thanks. Well, I haven't had coffee and I'm doing well, so okay. I'll take that. But how do we bring it down to the realm of something a little more concrete to give our listeners maybe some practices, especially if they go, well, I'm hearing what you're saying, but I'm not a lead pastor. I'm not the head of an organization. Maybe I don't even work within an organization. I'm a stay-at-home parent, whatever. What are some concrete practices that we would say that people could implement having listened to our conversation up to this point?
Yeah, well, one I would name is one that's already been sort of named towards the top is study the life of Jesus. How did Jesus exercise his authority? How did he have agency over his own life? And how did he exercise influence over the people around him? What are some of the ways that he taught his disciples to do the same? Yeah, that would be the first place to start.
Yeah, and that's a lifelong journey. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been at this for years and I'm still reading the Gospels and challenged to steward my power and authority in a more Christ-like way. I keep noticing new things and you know, it's disruptive. Mm-hmm. Jesus should disrupt you. Yes. That's just the reality. So if you're going to immerse yourself in the Gospels, which I think is a great lifelong commitment and practice, for disciples, it will continue to stretch you and grow you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just because you've heard the stories as a kid and maybe over and over since then doesn't mean you've necessarily seen everything that there is to see in them.
Yeah.
And I've been learning that myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, second practice would just begin to notice the power you do have and how you use it. So again, we all have it. It's always at play. So begin to just pay attention to how it's at play around you and how you wield your power in your relationships with other people. So, you know, Josiah, you keep coming back to parenting. That's a huge one. There's an intrinsic, inherent power differential between parents and their children. And so ask the question, how do I wield my power with my kids? Is it predominantly control and sort of command and control, or is it something different? And if so, what does it look like to continue to cultivate an imagination for power as self-sacrificial and liberating love. Mm-hmm. Another one would be work. A lot of our listeners are in the workforce in some way, shape, or form. How do you notice power at work in your work environment? If you're in a supervisory role, oh my goodness, so much to pay attention to regarding how you treat the people who report to you and what that looks like. Maybe another layer would just be to start noticing how power is at work in our broader culture. You know, some of this is at play. It's part of the conversation when it comes to racial tensions that exist. I have a son with a disability. There's lots of power dynamics with people who have disabilities. Mm-hmm. And I'm thankful that we've made a lot of progress. You know, half a century ago, individuals with Down syndrome were institutionalized. I'm very grateful that that's not the case anymore. And as a culture, it seems like we're trending in a good direction where we're noticing the dignity and value and worth of people who experience disabilities. But I'll also be honest with you. I still see ways for us to grow as a culture and as a society. I still see ways that people interact with Griffin and others that are dehumanizing and sort of unhelpful. We have a ways to go, right? So so it's kind of like audit your own relationships, maybe your marriage, your parenting, your workplace. Start noticing how things are at play in our broader culture.
Yeah. It's like a lens. We talk about putting lenses on.
Yes.
And put the power lens on and just observe where is it at play.
Yep.
And everything.
Yeah. The last one I would name is just commit to trafficking in the truth. We can all, no matter where we are in a given situation, I think we can all do our part to tell the truth of what happened. Whether we're the person who's been wronged or we're the person who has wronged someone else, or even just being a bystander, we can all make a commitment to tell the truth. If you're seeing someone in power abuse that power in toxic ways, speak up about it. There may be other people who see it, but who don't feel safe to speak up for whatever reason. And as disciple of Jesus, we are called to tell the truth, even when it requires courage.
Yes, so big picture, we all have power. Power is at play. Anytime human beings are interacting, power is at play. It's also neutral, so it's not necessarily good or bad, but how it impacts people around us is hangs on how we use it. And in unhealthy churches, this power is misused mainly for the purposes of coercion and control, but in healthy churches, and I would add healthy Christ followers, we learn how to relate to power in the way of Jesus. And that's what we're hoping to do.
Well, thanks for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Next time, we're going to name a final toxin in the American church soil and how to pivot towards greater health as a church. So we hope you'll continue to tune in.
Praxis is recorded and produced at Crosspoint Community Church. You can find out more about the show and our church at crosspointwi.com. If you have any questions, comments, or have any suggestions for future topics, feel free to send us an email. Also, if you enjoy the show, consider leaving a review. And if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.